Hi, this is Jeff Curto, professor of photography at College of DuPage in Glen Ellyn, Illinois, and welcome to a special field trip session for History of Photography, Photo 1105. Each semester, I take a small, volunteer group of students. It's an optional field trip for them to come to the Art Institute of Chicago Photography Study Room. This particular session happened this year on the 13th of March, Friday the 13th. And just before St. Patrick's Day here in Chicago, where we dye the fountains green because of Chicago's Irish population, and photography galleries at the Art Institute of Chicago has currently on exhibition an exhibition of 100 photographs by Josef Karsch, some extraordinary prints and some photographs of some extraordinary individuals. But our primary function in heading to the Art Institute of Chicago on Friday the 13th of March was, in fact, to go to the study facility, the photography study facility right in the middle of the photography galleries at the Art Institute of Chicago. Is a remarkable facility, a remarkable place to look at photographs, and there we were able to look at a large number of images, not in frames, not behind glass, and really get to know what the quality of these images is like. So here we are joining our small class group in the photography study facility at the Art Institute of Chicago on Friday, the 13th of March, 2009.
And a little bit of time talking about the idea of pictorial syntax, And just to kind of give you a sense of this idea of how meaning happens and maybe to give you some tools about thinking about how meaning happens, and also to give you some tools to kind of look at these photographs in a certain way, in a certain way with a certain sense of perspective. And of course, one of the reasons we have a course like this in the photography department is not only to sort of learn a little bit about the history of the medium, but also to learn a little bit about where we are in the history of the medium and about what to look for when we look at things and how to kind of contemplate what we see when we see it. So when I contact Newell to ask her about bringing a class group here, one of the things that I do is, and in fact she's got the Jeff list now, so she knows kind of what I'm looking for, but I ask her to bring out an overview of processes throughout the sort of history of the medium. So, we had the chance to look at that Talbot salted paper print and the daguerreotype and the autochrome, which are now away for the reasons that we've mentioned. And now if we look at what's up here, we have a variety of processes. I also wanted to mention, and I don't know if Newell may have mentioned this when she was talking to you before, but this is a very unusual facility. It's unusual in that there are very few museums like this that have a facility like this that you can actually come to. So you don't need me. You don't need to have any sort of special credential of any sort. You just need to be somebody interested in photography. And right in front of Newell, right where there she is, doing the Carol Merrill hold it up there, Newell is showing us these little quarter sheets of paper that she has over there that have the hours that they're available. And I always have said that I think I've learned more about photography in this room than in any other single room that I've studied photography in, because being able to come into this room and sit down at one of these tables with a box or two or three of photographs of photographer whose work you like and being able to look through them one image at a time, lay a couple out on the table to be able to compare them, and so forth and so on. And all you need to do is make an appointment. So the information about that is on the little sheet over there, and I would encourage you to do that because it's a really wonderful experience to be able to sit in here with a box of images and so forth. So, all right. So in language, we kind of know how syntax works, right? We have somewhere along the line assimilated the basic concepts of how a sentence goes together, subject, verb. We need something to name, and we need something that that name thing does, right? We have to have those two things in order to convey meaning. But one of the things that we've learned over time is that the meaning of words is often changeable, and that the way in which we order those words changes the way in which we think about what those words mean. So in the grammatical syntax of, that person is stealing my camera versus that camera is stealing my person. You know, those two statements are both statements, but they mean something very different, even though they use the same set of words. And I like to think about language when I look at photographs because they are, in fact, a language. And just like any other language, and those of us who, you know, how many speak a language other than the one that they were born into? You know, if you speak a language even sort of well, one of the things that you know is that there are only certain things you can say with the language that you have available to you. The bigger your vocabulary is, the more you're able to conjugate various verbs, the more likely you are to be able to actually affect communication in a significant way, right? So what we're looking at here is a set of linguistic, syntactic possibilities. Each photographer that we're looking at here had a set of language skills and a set of syntactical rules that applied to their ability to make images in a certain way. So let's talk about how the meaning of language changes. And I like to use a couple of examples. One of them is the word cool. Cool, you know, if my grandmother, born in 1900, were here. My grandmother was a woman who was always a little on the chilly side, and she was also the sort of person, if she was cold, you had to put on a sweater, right? And if she were to say, if we were to say, you know, you look cool to her, she'd go and get her little cardigan and put that on, because to her, that word cool meant that. Obviously, I can, you know, say, Kathy, that's a cool sweater you've got on. And Kathy will understand that word cool means something different. And so, and the interesting thing is that Kathy knows that the difference between the two sort of definitions of that word are significant. She understands them because they are part of her cultural understanding of what the syntactical rules that make that word mean something, how they've worked. Another one that I like, because I experience it every summer, I go to this place in northern Michigan where there is a town that was established in the late 19th century called Gay. And in Gay, there is a tavern, which of course is the gay bar. And this was a tavern established in the late 19th century. And of course, you know, they've sort of capitalized on their unusual name in the middle of northern Michigan in a sort of rural environment. But obviously, the town was a happy place to live, but we've sort of completely abandoned that meaning of the word, and now it means a whole different thing to us. So, but it took a long time. It took a long time for the word cool to change from my grandmother's understanding of what it was to, wow, that's a really cool hat, to our understanding that it is both of those things. It's cool out today, that's a cool hat. The same with the word gay, that the word gay over time changes, but it takes time for that change to be affected. So let's now apply that to this. And if we start looking at these things, one of the things that you may have noticed as you looked at this wall of images is that they are arranged in roughly chronological fashion, right? Oldest images on the left, newest images on the right. And one of the things that's interesting is that what we're looking at is not simply a visual progression, but rather a progression of process and how process enabled certain photographers and how those processes either enabled them or hindered them in certain ways. So, as an example, here's this Carlton Watkins large plate image. We've talked about Watkins quite a bit. We understand where this came from. Large glass plate negative, contact printed onto a piece of albumen printing paper. And we understand that in order to make that document, Watkins had to stand in that place with a camera that made a negative that big. No two ways around it. There is no way during his time period, using the technology available to him, to say what he wanted to say in a different way. He has to use the language, the syntax available to him at that particular time to be able to understand or to be able to create something that we would understand as this sort of grand landscape image. If we move down, oh, I don't know, down here, actually we could even go over to the Paul Caponegro images, is probably the easiest way, is to look at the idea that Caponegro may have made those with small negatives, and now he can enlarge them. He can enlarge them to however large he wants them to be. And he can enlarge them that size or bigger still, whereas Watkins is stuck. His understanding of the language of photography is stuck in this particular time with this particular set of materials. The other thing that's interesting here is that if we were to look at, say, just this group of images that is, you know, roughly between the O'Sullivan and the LeGray and so forth and so on down to the end here, that what we're looking at are a variety of different language possibilities of expressing oneself. So when we look at the Emerson image is a photogravure. We talked about what that was, a high-quality ink-based photographic image. So it isn't using metallic, light-sensitive materials, at least not in the final form of the print, but it is a possibility that, as you may recall, Emerson was really interested in because of what that represented. It represented something that was very similar to traditional printmaking, and it allowed him to produce something that, to him, looked like what he wanted photography to look like. If we jump down here to this Frederick Evans platinum print, I guess there must be two, there are two Frederick Evans platinum prints here, that Evans is saying what he wants to say using that technology. And one of the things I hope you can you get a chance to take a look at is how I had mentioned in class, even I think just this week, about platinum prints, that there is this sort of, a tactile quality to them. Because unlike every or most of these other images that are here, the emulsion of a platinum print is actually contained within the fibers of the paper instead of sitting on top of it in an emulsion. So what I'm trying to point out here is that each one of these language choices is in fact stuck in time. God bless you. Is that out, all the way out there? Whoa, dude. That was a loud sneeze through the glass wall there. So each one of these syntactic, linguistic possibilities is stuck in time. Stuck in time in its own time. And we've talked about this image. It might be hopefully fun for you to see this live, kind of a cool thing. We've talked about this several times, Gustave Legray's image, multiple print, combination print. And, of course, one of the things that it represents is one of the first places where photographers began to explore the idea of synthetic imagery, making something that didn't exist out of component parts. So at this point, language changes. And one of the things that's really, really interesting to me is how with the words that we talked about, cool, gay, it takes this long time for the word to change, decades in some cases. And ultimately, the words change enough so that it's really easy for us to understand both sets of meanings. But with photography, syntax can change overnight. Suddenly, somebody invents a new process, or somebody thinks of a new way of using existing processes, and suddenly the way photography can communicate changes overnight. Unlike language, we have this sort of amazing set of technological imperatives that at once limit and enable photographers. One of the things that I find really fascinating when looking at this group of images, though, and part of it is the sort of dialogue that Newell and I have had over the years as I've done this session with students, is that you may have noted that some of the processes that are on the left-hand side, the old-fashioned processes, are repeated as we go along. So that when we get down here, we're still now looking at platinum prints, platinum palladium prints, palladium, a sort of poor cousin, poor sister of platinum. It's much cheaper than platinum material. It's often used as a sort of augmented metal within a platinum emulsion to keep the cost down, but it also changes the coloration of the image, oftentimes to a kind of brownish color rather than a more neutral color of a straight platinum print. So it sort of like serves two purposes, warming it up and also keeping the emulsion at a slightly lower cost in terms of the overall cost of the material to produce a print. So why is it that Roger Vail is using platinum? He's a photographer working more or less now. So he has all the language possibilities that exist. Why would he use this old-fashioned method? He likes it. He likes it, says Kathy. He just likes it. And that's it, isn't it? He likes it. He likes it in the same way that, you know, maybe a poet may use a word that is old-fashioned to describe something because it fits the way he feels about the topic that he's writing about. So the same thing here is happening over and over and over again. So, you know, and somebody had mentioned, I don't, you know, that obviously this is a cyanotype image. We'd already just recently looked at some cyanotype images being made. Well, what was...
This is so much nicer
than the ones that... Well, this is done by somebody who's maybe done more than one cyanotype, right? So we have some cyanotype images by students on the wall. There were some, a few that were nice. And we talked about how it was this process that was easily done and therefore was very popular with amateur photographers. But one of the other interesting things, and if we don't have any examples from the 19th century over on the left-hand side, but obviously one of the deals here is that this is not only a cyanotype, but also a photogram.
Yeah, photogram.
Photogram, you're right. You're right, it's a photogram. So the idea that this sort of basic concept of photography that was practiced by the beginning photographers as they began to experiment with light-sensitive materials is now being co-opted, not only in terms of the color. So, you know, obviously one of the big parts of this image is its color. The color of the image is significant. One of the other interesting things about what's up here is that with the possible exception of the embroidery that's on the Betty Hahn image, everything here is monochromatic. And yet, one of the things that you'll look at when you look at this is like, you know, there isn't anything you could really call a black and white image, is there? There are warm, cool, brown, ochre, purple, tan, all of these amazing colors in monochrome images. And it's really one of the greatest things about being here is to be able to see that these images that we see reproduced in books or, you know, worse yet, in some ways on the web, and so forth and so on, are never really what these things look like, right? And so the actual experience of these objects is being able to see them in this way is really significant. The other thing that's really significant to think about is that every photograph we look at in class, with a few exceptions, is much, much, much larger on our screen than it is here, right? So scale actually matters quite a lot. And in fact, even just looking at this Karsh exhibition, if you've not seen Karsh photographs outside of reproduced form in books or magazines or whatever, seeing some of the larger scale 11 by 14, 16 by 20 prints that are out in this exhibition are pretty wonderful. So it is pretty wonderful to see those things. So the point I want to make here is really that photographers have a set of possible linguistic, syntactic things that they can do. And yet, as new things, new technologies come along, you know, we talked about how Stieglitz was oftentimes cropping away sections of his negatives and enlarging only a portion of them rather than using the entire thing. So, and that's a technological enablement, right? It's just something that he can do that photographers before him either didn't want to take the time to do or didn't know how to do or didn't have the right materials to be able to do. But as we now go along, we begin to see photographers who may not be using large format cameras, maybe using small format cameras and making enlarged images. And here is, you know, one of my favorite contemporary photographers, the Park Harrisons. It's a husband and wife team. And we'll look at their work actually coming up a little bit in class. They're sort of, in some ways, mimicking many of the 19th century conventions of the way photographs look, the physical look of them. And they're mimicking not only sort of the stylistic things, and we'll even see some places in their work where they're very clearly referencing 19th century photographs by O'Sullivan and some of the other landscape photographers, but they're also mimicking the sort of qualitative look. And this is a, I think, a photogravure image. So it's reproduced in ink, painstaking, high-quality process to reproduce something in ink that can then be reproduced multiple times so that they can happen. Another really significant thing here is that multiple times thing. We are looking at individual images that probably exist in multiple replicas all over the world. Some of them do, some of them don't. You know, the daguerreotype that we looked at, there's one. That's it. But everything else exists, at least probably, in multiple replicas, sometimes 2 or 3, sometimes 2 or 300, sometimes 2 or 3,000, depending on what it is and where it came from. So the other part of photography's syntax is this, what William Ivens, who was the curator of traditional lithographs and etchings and so forth at the Metropolitan Museum, Ivens called this exactly repeatable pictorial statements. The ability to exactly repeat one pictorial statement over and over and over and over again so that it could be distributed. And in the history of art, that only happened in lithography, etching, and photography. The ability to reproduce something over and over again and distribute those images. Something else that I want to just make sure that I don't forget to mention is this Sally Mann photograph over here, which is made with wet plate collodion and then enlarged, that wet plate collodion negative enlarged onto larger photographic printing paper, and that's what we see there. So, and of course, Sally Mann sort of playing with the imperfections of that process as much as the sort of high quality of the process that would have attracted Carlton Watkins. And, you know, the thing that I find fascinating is as we go down through this set of images, that each photographer is using the language available to them at a given time to do the thing that they want to do. But as the language grows bigger, every photographer, every successive generation of photographers has a greater sense of possibilities. So that Roger Vail could have made these prints in silver gelatin, he could have made them in platinum, he could have made them in gravure, he could have made them in a variety of different ways. He could have shot them with an 8x10-inch view camera, as I suspect he probably did, or he could have shot them with a 35mm camera and then enlarged that negative in order to make his platinum prints. So he has all of these possibilities of the way he can express himself using the languages, the language elements that are available to him at the time. This Adam Fuss image, I wonder what year that was, 92. So here he is making a photogrammic image by placing this child on a tray of some sort of liquid over a piece of photographic emulsion, shining light through it, making a photogram, but making a photogram that, unlike other photograms, has this sort of surprising element of motion. You know, usually photograms aren't about movement. They're about being still. And then this Susan Durges photograph, and whenever I look at them, and Newell always brings one out because I just think they're so interesting conceptually that I remember seeing the very first one of these that I saw, which was in this room with a class group. And what Susan Durges does is she rigs up electronic flash units up in the trees and then comes back at night with a piece of photographic printing paper, unrolls it underneath the surface of water, and then fires the flashes through the water. So what we're looking at is a photogram of moving water using photographic materials. So if we, you know, if we were to have back over here, if we were to have a photogram from Niepce or Fox Talbot way back over here, we can see that basically the exact same pieces of technology are being used in those two end pieces. Light shining through objects that are either variously opaque or translucent or transparent and affecting light-sensitive material underneath them. But what's changed is the thought process behind what it is that is being imaged, stopping motion, allowing motion to be part of the image, creating shadow pictures that aren't really of objects themselves, creating the illusion of depth. Whereas Niepce and Fox Talbot were probably just simply pleased to have objects where the material worked. And I was pleased actually last night that John Paul referenced a number of things about history and about the history of the medium and about Fox Talbot and about Niepce and about Daguerre and about how these were experiments. You know, we look at the images that they made, but we have no idea about the thousands and thousands of things that they threw away, right? You know, so when you throw away your efforts of, you know, making photographs, you can understand that it's you're just part of a continuum of people who have made a mistake, you know. That's how we learn to do something new and different, so.
Mm-hmm.
Rolls it up, puts it in a dark tube, sure. Takes it back to the dark room and processes it. Yeah, I mean, I suppose if it dried out in the noonday sun or something, it would be a big deal. But it's, you know, if she just packages it in water, you know. I don't know. You should try it. I mean, I think it's one of those things where you just, you know, sort of slap your head and think. How just the thought process of it. Yeah, and I think that's in some ways what great photography often is just it's not the image itself. You know, it's what I've been sort of saying all along. The technology of photography is not that hard. It really isn't. At the bottom of it, while it may seem like swimming upstream for a year or 6 months or a week or whatever, ultimately it's pretty simple. And it's getting simpler every day, right? You know, it's not that hard. But it's the process of what to do with it, what to say, where to place the camera, what you're trying to convey and communicate. I'm also intrigued by the idea of using tintype. And in fact, we've looked at a couple of, I think we've looked, maybe I haven't brought those in yet, but some contemporary photographers using tintype technology. And of course, one of the marvelous aspects of that image is its imperfections. The little bubbles and streaks and things of that, you know, image of the bat skeleton. So, and obviously, it's not just about an image of a bat skeleton. It's about an image of a bat skeleton with that set of feelings based on the way it looks. So, all right, that's all I wanted to say. So, brief sort of a comment. Does anybody have any questions or thoughts or? Brick bats, throw anything at me, not at the images. Why, Newell, you've changed.
I have a question about the Timothy O'Sullivan. And the print, from what we can see without touching it and looking it up, looks like it's been glued to or applied to that cardstock, like we've seen in some of the smaller pictures that we've.
How should I?
Please do. I was actually about to call you over. This is Jim Ishka, and he is. Are you a conservator?
Preparator.
Here at, in the photography department. So I'll bet you can answer that question.
Yeah, if I can open it for you, and I can.
What I'm curious about is, and I'm running getting at is, as a preservationist kind of a thing. I'm assuming back then, everything they would have mounted the pictures onto was acid.
Oh, yes. You can see how the color. These are all from albums. These are Sullivan. And they would have been, their albumin.
But they were actually glued with some form of a glue onto that album paper?
I would assume.
How do you preserve it? I mean, it's literally adhered to something which is.
Well, you know, the. Real trick is to make sure that the materials that come in contact with the print are themselves acid-free. That's the best we can do. There's not real tricks that we perform on this. There are certain deacidification processes if there's a real issue. However, usually when you try to do a treatment on a photograph, it's a very iffy matter sometimes you're liable to do more harm than good. So basically, we just make sure that they're kept in the best.
Sort of like the physician's mantra: first, do no harm.
Right. Exactly.
Right. You know, you don't want to mess something up while trying to fix it. So. Mm-hmm. And of course, part of the appeal of this particular image is not just the image itself, but the fact that it is in the album page, and that it has the text accompanying it that mm-hmm. describes it, and so forth and so on. So,
that's simple.
If all of you want to come up and look at it,
Newell's
now back, so she's keeping
an eagle eye. No, that's all right, Jim. Jim volunteered.
War Department.
He didn't want me to come up.
No, I did. I was happy to have you here.
So have any of these pictures been restored? Like chemically changed to...
You know, a lot of times I'll just get retouched.
Just watch your back.
Some retouching involved, but very, very rarely. No, most of them are pretty much as a...
Oh, and I'm amazed that they look
other than the matting.
Like, there is some discoloration on the staircase one that I'm assuming is the egg.
Well, yeah.
And then and the
knife,
too.
The albumin prints are all, I don't know.
Once Matt, once the albumin print. And you can tell, like, when you look in here, it's all shiny like eggs are, but that one's not.
You're right. I'm not 100% sure. I've never made albumin prints. It was a while ago. Yeah, I'm not sure how the formula is different for making it.
And it's probably not as yellow either.
Well, a lot of that comes from the age. Mm-hmm. And if you've ever seen a new albumin print, freshly made albumin print, they're not yellow. They're more purple. They're very brown.
And it also depends on how they were treated during the processing. Oftentimes, albumin prints were toned in gold, which gave them a kind of a rich purpley brown characteristic. And you know, are these vintage prints?
I believe so. This one is in very good shape. Take a look. Actually, we'll close this one up.
Thanks, Jim. Jim's taking his time
to
do all this stuff.
Yes, we store everything. Not everything, but most everything of a reasonable size.
Did you put the tissue between each one too?
Yeah. We use glass seam, which is a semi-transparent material. And the reason is because it's semi-transparent, we can go through stacks of prints and see what they are rather than having to open up each one. So it's kind of a trade-off. The glass seam is slightly abrasive, more so than traditional mounting tissue, but you know, the act of opening everything up.
Right.
So the little two niblets at the top of the image are plate holder pieces that would have held the glass plate into the holder.
The two little black marks.
Right.
Yeah. But the circular part is the lens.
It's the vignetting from the lens. So he's raising.
You can see the marks down here too. Try not to touch.
Yeah.
Don't touch. Not even trying not to touch. You're not.
But this.
It was a mother's voice.
It was. Yeah. Don't. I want to keep coming back. See.
This print is on a somewhat thicker stuff. Traditionally, albumin prints are very, very thin stock, almost a tissue.
Cracked.
Right.
If they've not been well handled, they often have a, if they've been bent even just a little bit, because it's egg white, it cracks, and if the paper is often very thin, so. Unless I'm wrong, am I right about this, that you and Russell and Glenn Hansen Russell Phillips, Glenn Hanson were in school together?
Yeah, we were.
Okay. Because I know that most of these folks know Glenn and Russell, so at the ID. So
they're much older than I am.
That was going to be my next sentence. My next sentence is that they are much older.
They were in grad school.
Obviously. And you were an undergrad at the Institute of Design. So all right.
Yeah. So is Russell there?
Russell, yeah. Russell's one of our adjunct guys. Yeah.
One of your.
He's an adjunct part-time guy.
Yeah. Well, they were big guys. Well. Glenn, was he doing die transfer?
Yeah.
Yeah. Russell, of course.
Mr. Die Transfer.
Mm-hmm. So. You don't have any?
No.
So do you know the provenance on all these prints? Like, you know where it's been handled, stored, or?
Generally, when we acquire something, but sometimes it's sometimes so old. And quite honestly, years ago people, you know, so
I wonder where some of these have been stored for 100 years. They've been stored somewhere, or on somebody's wall, or
that's a lot of these in albums.
That statement you just made is really, I mean, it's a really significant one, that people didn't care.
Right.
I mean, they didn't even maybe know to care, mm-hmm. I think, as much as anything, right? Mm-hmm. You know?
Photography was,
so.
It was not considered by most women.
You mentioned you went to ID.
Institute of Design.
Institute of Design, which was at IIT.
Oh, at IIT, so it had already moved
Yes. Not the Art Institute.
The Art Institute, yeah. Different school altogether.
Yeah. But the Institute.
What once was, like
what
that.
Once was.
Yeah.
Do they not have it because they don't think it's part of design work, or they don't have the...
I don't really know what the history of its dissolution is, other than...
They don't even do design anymore. It's more theory of design.
Huh. Instead of actual.
Actual design, market research. It's all beyond me. I don't know. When I talk to people who go there, I have no idea. This I can understand. Design, you know, designing cup holders, I can understand. Do you want to, would you like to see anything else?
Can we see this one?
Yeah.
I know.
Oh, no.
Oh, it's thousand. Oh, my goodness.
Made the carbon prints. Yeah.
It is people that realize a lot of classes come in here. They get the lecture.
Yeah, the books. It's always interesting to me because it happens. It happens or has happened in my classes too. It's like they're books, you know.
Look at all those images.
These are
but these are the actual.
These are the actual images as opposed
to
books.
To be able to see them without having to look through glass. Mm-hmm. Reproduction.
Which one do you want to look at?
Well, it's between these two. Either one.
No. And not just one, right? That's the thing that I'm always amazed by.
Oh my goodness!
Is not just one, but you know, many, many of them, dozens.
In the woods, and you're not pulling up the van.
So it's from an album that had to have multiple. Can you imagine just the size of that book and how heavy the book would be?
And when you think about that, when you literally like think about how many plates and the fact that they came back with anything. And then you look at how beautiful they are and how sensitively seen they are, so many of them. You know, it's just, it is mind-boggling to me.
So the print is actually the whole thing,
negative.
The negative. It's like the whole
thing.
Whole and
sheet.
So,
yeah.
Right, it's one sheet is what I'm asking. That we're looking at. It's one.
Well.
With the printing on it.
This darker color that's in here is not image. So it's just up to where the actual image is.
The image is glued onto the paper.
Correct.
The print is, yeah.
The print
ends at this is the border of the print. And then
it's still thin
so
paper.
It's like covering
it's very thin. Just to handle the paper and to mount it like this.
So they have print is on a piece of paper, or is it? I mean, you can't even tell.
Print.
You have a whole collection of negatives, too?
No.
No.
We have some, but we don't collect negatives.
Like, are there any glass plate negatives?
Yeah, there's somewhere. I don't know where. The Watkins archive. I don't know if these still exist, but probably somewhere.
Well, he lost most of them in the.
Oh, that's right.
In
that. That's right. You're right. Absolutely. That's right.
Which would be really hard on.
Somewhere, when I was in graduate school at Bennington College in North Bennington, Vermont, there was a house called the Park McCullough House. It had belonged to the Park McCullough family. And while it was being restored, a huge box of Carlton Watkins photographs and negatives was discovered in the attic of the building. And they were all of railroads. Railroad stuff, and the Park McCulloughs had been very heavily involved in the railroad business. So, but there were large negatives, and I can't remember who the dealer was, who came up, but came up from New York to, you know, evaluate them and buy them, I think. So. Wet plate Colonial negative. An albumin print. What time is it? 3:15. 2:15. 2:15. Not 3:15.
It's 3:33.
Shh.
Why are we stopping? Because it looked like 3:15.
No.
That's why it was.
Okay. So one more.
Thanks, Jim.
I know. I love seeing you with those.
It's a specialized. You don't have anything to do? It's Friday.
Where's Anne?
Oh,
I don't know where Anne is. She's supposed to have come with her daughter.
Otherwise,
she'd be
in there.
No, that's right.
So this is a photo of your. You know what those are.
You just never saw. I never saw.
Yeah, they're in person. They're just spectacular.
I don't think I imagined. I mean, I know you said they were a full song. But
yeah, they don't. Yeah, when you
time.
Say it's an image reproduced in ink, it doesn't really convey the sense of what it is that it looks like. So.
So is this the inkjet of the?
not really. A little more labor intensive than the whole push button inkjet thing.
But this ink was ink available at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Like India ink? I mean, what
kind
of
ink did they have? Like printer's ink, right?
Like for newspapers.
Yeah, the ink itself is not the special component of it. It's the bits and pieces that come in between the negative and actually making a plate that gets inked up, which is that's the sort of magical, labor-intensive.
The way you described it, what I was thinking about was these old duplicator machines where there was this plastic film, and when you typed on it, it created a transparency in that plastic.
It's kind of not unlike that.
Then you put it on the drum, and ink went through it.
Well, except that there's like another step beyond that, because once you've created this carbon paper, carbon tissue resist, that acts as something that goes onto the plate and then is etched with acid, so that the plate then is raised or lowered depending on the value of what's there, and then more or less ink sticks to that. Simplified a little, but pretty close.
Wow. The deeper the etching.
The deeper the etching, the more ink is going to stick into that etching of the plate, and therefore the more ink gets transferred to the piece of paper when it's placed in contact. So.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jim.
The History of Photography podcast is a member of the Photocast Network. Find this and other photography podcasts at photocastnetwork.com, your photography resource in the podosphere.